So do we keep our senses focused on terrestrial affairs, the energy crisis, economic growth, commerce and finance, war and armaments? Or is that pathway leading to ultimate disaster? Or will the silvery voices open our awareness to other realities and a wider universe?
Oh, I don't know. Hey, look, here's one of the strange voices he recorded. It's only 17 seconds.
I was wondering if you're going to get to that.
How about Dead Machines? That's a good one.
Dead Machines. Dead Machines. Dead Machines.
And that's the VVP voice?
Yeah.
That's very clear.
Yeah. What is very strange, Walter, is that did you listen to that? You haven't. I'm sure you didn't have time because I just posted it today. The show with Paul last week or 2 weeks ago?
I saw that you posted it, but I haven't listened to it yet because I saw it like 10 minutes before I was going to get ready to leave.
Well, what happened during the show was he was telling a story about going ghost hunting at this thing when he was at the East Coast Para Conference.
Yeah.
They had them all go into there were a few ghost hunting things, but this one was that's good. Walter is resting the microphone stand on his stomach. He's leaning way back.
Yes, I am leaning way back, smartasses, so I am not sitting up.
But he went in this old theater, and he said that this is the only time it had happened to him since he was working on that ghost cases, where he felt like this very strange temperature differential and some kind of a constriction around his throat.
So he experienced some serious phenomena then.
Yeah. And the funny thing, you know, he's not one to go, oh, well, you know, he's not one to get freaked out by it, but that freaked him out.
And he's, as far as ghosts are concerned, he's not like the hardcore skeptic that's out there debunking everything.
No. I mean, he was open to it.
But he's reasonable.
And stuff happened to him. So he was like, well, okay, I guess stuff happens.
Yeah.
But while in the middle of describing, and we'll get to the opening here, in the middle of describing what was happening to him, he said, I'm going to give you the whole background for it and what happened. And it's like, you know, it takes him about 10 minutes to tell the story. Right during the part in the story where he said, it felt like something was choking me or constricted around my neck. No other time in the show, but right then you hear this male voice, high pitched, going, but when I posted it, I was going to tell people where it was, and I thought, nah, I'm not going to tell them. Because I want you to listen to it and see if you can hear
it. Yeah, you want to catch it.
Yeah.
I'll listen to that when I get home, definitely.
I was trying to find I sent the recording of it, like a snippet of it, that night, because I listened back to it. And wait, let's see if I can find it. Here it is, if this plays properly. This is what it sounded like when he was talking.
My neck, and this it wrapped around my neck and constricted. You know, I had this feeling.
Did you hear it?
Yeah.
It became minus 50 degrees around my neck, and this it wrapped around my neck and constricted. You know, I had this feeling.
Wow. And he can't explain. It was no one with him or anything?
There were people with him. Holly was with him. Holly Stevens was with him on the first one.
Yeah.
Which is what he was describing. But she wasn't standing there. I think they were either in dark or pitch black. And he said that she wasn't standing right next to him. Besides, it wasn't like you would feel hands.
But the laugh there was nobody.
He was by himself place there.
Oh, that's good stuff. That's creepy stuff.
Yeah, so, and then later I said, what, you know, did you hear that? And Paul said, what? What are you talking about? And then Gorightly and Miles Lewis, who are listening, said, yeah, I heard it.
50 degrees around my neck. And this, it wrapped around my neck and constricted. Like, you know, I had this feeling.
That's
weird.
Good. That's good stuff.
I liked it.
The phenomenon that I experienced in December of 1998 was a woman crying, very clear. I've talked about it here before, I think, clear as my voice is now. And I wasn't scared. It wasn't scary. It was kind of, wow, listen to that. And everybody who was in the house was upstairs, and this was coming from downstairs. And I got the explanation. Now, here's what's interesting. I think since I talked about this house, and we'll get to the the reason I'm here eventually soon enough, but this is interesting stuff.
Walter hasn't been here in a while, so we have to talk a little.
This house that you've heard me talk about, I don't know if I've ever mentioned that it is now. You can find it online. Pictures of it. This very house, if over the years you've heard me talk about going to my mentor's house and this ghost story, this antebellum mansion, which I believe that Thomas Jefferson visited it, and some others. It's the, I think it's called the Pope Golson House, G-O-L-S-E-N, and it's in Prattville, Alabama.
Yeah.
And the owners, after my aunt and uncle sold it a few years back, of course, they took these wonderful black and white photos of the exterior and interior. And the top of the stairs, the landing that I'm talking about that led to the room I stayed in, it's one of the photos. And that's where I was standing when I heard the ghost coming up from downstairs at the bottom of this winding staircase, which, by the way, when Jefferson visited the house, which tells you how old the house is. He liked the stairwell.
Thomas Jefferson.
Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Thomas Jefferson. He liked the winding staircase so much that he had his architect on the Monticello repair after the fire get the blueprints, and they created a replica of that staircase from the Pope Golson house, but it winds in the opposite direction. Which I'd like to explore all the potential esoteric implications of that.
Yeah.
You know, possibly there. But interesting house. And I've spent I spent a lot of time in there when my uncle and aunt owned it. But anyway, it might be that the next guy I'm writing about, who I won't reveal yet, visited that house also. I'm looking into that. But anyway.
Oh, what? Get your hands up.
Stand where you are. Don't move.
Don't reach for them guns.
Take it easy, you galoots. Put away the hardware and relax.
It's Greg.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso.
Yeah, I just told Walter that I think that that is the longest cold opening I've ever had. I think clocked in at 20 minutes before the theme music came on.
That's what, when I was checking my cell phone to make sure the ringer was down, I was like, oh, 20 into it. That was a good one.
Yeah.
But
it's a new record.
I think EVP stuff is cool when it's real.
Yeah, well, yeah. But what is real?
That's true. Some people out there going, what do you mean, Bosley? What do you mean real? None of it's real. It's all bullshit. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know if too many of those people listen to this show. I've actually found out that through commentary, people are kind of on the same wavelength. It's kind of like, I'm very interested in this stuff. Let's see what's going on. Let's not freak out.
It's just a different part of the spectrum of belief, right?
Yeah. I think I've drawn the spectrum of the belief that that this show deserves.
There you go.
Because I get a few less of, you know, people saying, you know, why'd you have that idiot on, and a few less people saying, it's all true. I don't know why you doubt it. You know.
Oh no. Oh no.
So that, you know, I used to get more of those, and now it's kind of more excluded middle type people. Walter Bosley has not been here in quite a while because he's doing other stuff and
doesn't have money for gasoline.
Is it true? Can I take you to Denny's afterwards?
Well, I'm taking you to Denny's. You bought the beer and the snacks.
Oh, okay. That's good because
Denny's on me.
You know, my unemployment ran up about 3 weeks ago.
Uh-oh.
I'm Poe now. I'm not Poe. I'm just living on my
I get my little bit of money from Amazon.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you know, a little bit from Lulu if the printed copies sell. But people...
Sorry, I'm eating Chex Mix and drinking Modelo here. I got beer and Chex Mix for Walter and I.
For all the people I hear that insist that they just don't like reading them digital books, I really do sell my digital books 100 to 1. Now, folks, when you hear me say 100 to 1, it doesn't mean I'm selling thousands of copies of my books. That's all relative, but because I really...
With a small sample size, it appears to be about 100 to 1.
Yeah, exactly. That, honestly, that would be the rate.
So out of 300, you'd have three printed copies.
Yeah. That's why I kind of preach the gospel of digital. I love digital. Kept my label alive. You guys have heard me say that. But,
yeah.
But my printed copies, as you can see by this, my one printed copy I have of the Burton book so far, they do a pretty good job.
I like the picture of Burton where you can see the big javelin scar in his face.
Yeah, the scar.
Yeah.
Where he took that that Somali javelin spear right through the face. You can see a really good depiction of that in the film Mountains of the Moon, which I highly recommend. Patrick Bergen did an excellent job portraying Burton.
Yeah, so. People that listen to the show know who Walter is. I will not bore you with an introduction. You know, somebody just put up something saying, how do we... I answered already on the UFO updates list. One of the members said, how do we know Bosley wasn't involved in the same crap as Richard Doty? And I said, he was, just not in the same way. He wasn't out there disinforming UFO people, if that's what you're saying.
My question is, who was the newbie who asked that? Because we've covered that a long time.
Well, no. See, this is on the UFO updates list. He said, I read somewhere, and I said... I said, please listen to my shows wherever they say Walter Bosley, you'll get a good idea of where he's coming from.
Yeah, I've said it elsewhere that I never even met Doty. He was just brought up one time as a cautionary tale when I was a new agent.
Yeah.
I mean, he was indeed.
He was that famous.
You know, he was, but that was the only time. And that's why I also don't judge the guy, too. So, but that's well covered elsewhere. For the newbies.
Right. I judge him, but I am not, like a lot of things, as you know me, I'm not self-righteously indignant about stuff. Because it's just, what, I'm better than that person? Who am I to say I'm better than somebody? So I'm never like, we're wagging the finger, you know. It's like, you know, what are you, five? What are you, 5 years old?
Right.
Don't be wagging the finger. You can ask questions, like... What exactly did he do? Was it morally, you know, unacceptable? It's like, yes, some of the stuff he did was morally unacceptable. And I do not agree with it. But I know what he was doing, and I know what his motivation was. Doesn't make it right. I wouldn't have done it. I condemn it morally, but I'm not going to preach to you about it.
Yeah, and, you know, I've stated my position was that
Walters is a little different.
I only disagree with them where they should have clearly seen where they were affecting – Benowitz's mental state and backed off immediately. Yeah. But other than that, he wasn't doing anything wrong. Other than when that happened, that started to happen, that was not cool.
Right.
But anyway.
Let's move on to the actual, and we can carry it a little late if you want the full 2 hours of actually talking about the new book, Secret Missions to Sir Richard Francis, The Lost Expedition of Sir Richard Francis Burton.
That's a mouthful.
Which I read half of about 3 weeks ago, and I read the other half today. And I did get to the absolute end of the book. Walter read the epilogue and everything.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Yeah, cool.
Well, I'm not – you know what? I've said I am not going to shortchange Walter this time. I'm going to read the whole damn thing.
Well, I think you read the whole one last time.
I read
– The Cabrillo book?
Or? I read 83% of it by the time we talked. See that? And I came up with questions. Which we may or may not get to all of.
Well, start with them.
I'll start with them. Why this book, Walter? What How should we start this? It's about Sir Richard Francis Burton, which people know of.
Right.
And I knew of him. I knew what some of the things he'd done, but not everything. In the first 30, 40 pages of the book, you go into that.
Yeah.
So in a nutshell, without just zipping through what you say in the book, who is Burton? Why should we care? Besides the fact that he's a fascinating character.
Yeah, that's why you should care, primarily. Actually, Sir Richard Francis Burton contributed greatly to geographical and ethnological science. He was a linguist extraordinaire. He provided the English-speaking world with the first translations of some very important classic works of literature, like the Arabian Nights. His Arabian Nights was not the first English translation, but it has been the most lasting in the English-speaking world. It's considered the best. He was the first English translator of the Kama Sutra, which, you know, a lot of people could get a lot of good from by reading it and learning some techniques and just make their marriages and relationships even better. He was – here's what's interesting. He was, underneath it all, the philosopher-scientist who, by being an extraordinarily astute technical scientist, he managed to gain the tremendous respect of the Royal Society, and particularly the Royal Geographical Society, in an era where they had shortly before his time, had rejected the whole philosopher-scientist notion. You know, did that make sense? Basically, he was just a very well-rounded guy with what he did. He understood the value of detail and getting things technically accurate as a scientist, but also he appreciated the more esoteric philosophical aspects of world history and anthropology and things like that. So probably most people know him as one of the famous African explorers of Africa. Excuse me. He was British, English born in Torquay, Devon.
Yeah,
Torquay. And he was one of the more famous explorers of Africa. He went in search of the source of the Nile. He did not find it himself technically, but he was instrumental in
blazing a trail in
subsequent analyses of other people's data. He was instrumental in helping to identify those who did, you know, the finding of the source of the Nile. So he was involved in that, but he was also a soldier. He was an intelligence officer. And from there, really, is where my book kind of takes off. That gets into his more esoteric philosopher-scientist.
Okay. It's kind of accepted that he had what we would call an intelligence capacity, mm-hmm. doing what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
How deep does that go, do you think? I mean, it's very deep in the book.
Mm-hmm. How deep did it go with him and what he did?
I mean, was he just going around gathering information on stuff like who was doing what? What building was next to what building? Who was friendly with the Sultan and who wasn't? No.
And this is why I was motivated to write the book. What I knew, and just for the listeners who are really new to him, he was born in 1821.
Yes, thank you.
And died in 1890. So this is the era. He was very much the 19th century man. Again, this is somebody who I had admired greatly of what I knew about him. And I was actually in the middle of a novel and was just doing some free reading when I stumbled upon, in the biography of Burton, I stumbled upon a little tidbit I didn't know. And that was the missing period while he was in South America. He spent 3 years in South America on consular duties, but it was the last 6 months which were the big mystery that motivated me to write this book. Because this is a man who wrote profusely and prolifically about everything he did, and yet there are two periods.
Even boringly so.
I even comment on there that I...
The trip to California from Utah thing, which we'll get into.
Ooh, yeah, that was talk about bone dry. Good Lord, Richard. Anyway, he wrote about everything he did except this brief period in the United States in 1860, but then even more conspicuously in South America, a period of 6 months of which technically we know roughly what he was doing in the first 2 months of that, but he himself didn't write about that period. And then there's really the core 4 months, 120 days thereabouts, that he did not write a word publicly and did not ever – he would give an anecdote at holidays about the journey through the Andes and being chased by Indians through the mountain pass in Chile on Christmas and killing four of them and all this stuff. But that was nothing more than an apocryphal tale that he would tell. There is no evidence that...
So with the exception of going through the American South pre-Civil War, which is also interesting and we'll talk about, as far as you know and as far as people know and as far as the historical record is, from when he started writing about his adventures to when he stopped, these are the only two times he didn't document where he was and what he was doing.
That's right.
Okay.
And that's astonishing.
Yes.
It just really piqued my curiosity.
Because he did this even when he was sick and indisposed. He would write about stuff.
Well, and as you know, in the book I go into, he used his illnesses to his benefit. And I would say...
He called in sick.
I argue, yeah, that he used his sick leave, probably with the full knowledge of his intelligence masters. But I think he... And I explain why in the book, and we can go into that later. But this intrigued me. That's understating it. It jumped off the page at me. I went, yeah. What? What do you mean? Whoa. And then, of course, you guys know what I'm into and what I research, and the fact that he was in South America, of all places. Come on. And
I didn't even know he went there, up to reading
right,
your book.
Yeah. And so I stopped writing this novel. It was my fourth pulp novel in as many months. I stopped cold writing the novel and jumped into, I think I did 4.5 months or so of research on this, and then spent a few weeks to a month writing it. I could not write this book. This one's truly this for me was like Empire of the Wheel 2, Friends from Sonora, when I stumbled upon the At a Place possibility. And I wrote that in kind of a white heat. This was just as inspiring and motivating. And so that's why this book happened.
Any nasty reviews, comments, or anything yet? It's just
not
too
yet.
New. It's too new for that.
Not yet, but I always, after each interview show, I always see what emerges.
Yes.
Because there's always somebody out there that doesn't like you personally.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is, and I was telling Walter this before we started, while the EVP thing was playing, was that once again I started reading Walter's book, and when he starts going into if he was here at this time, based on what he was doing before and what he said, what can we deduce about what he was doing there? And you start going, wait. There's no documentation for this. It's like, well, if there's no documentation for it, we're free to speculate, are we not?
That's right.
So, after it took me about 20, 30 pages to switch off and just say, let me just read it, read what Walter's saying, and have fun. And when I did that, just like his other books, it's like,
and
the idea is, let's go somewhere where nobody else has gone and see how it holds up.
Yeah.
Right now and in the future.
Yeah.
As more things come to light. Start a debate. What the hell? So that's why I was asking, any criticism yet?
Not yet. I think...
Because if somebody could just answer stuff and say, there's a manuscript saying he did this at this time. And it was found at so-and-so, it's just not on the internet yet. Well, okay, I'll take a look at it.
Or, well, remember, my sources were... the biographical material. That's where I got
this. There's
from.
A lot of biographical material.
From the three modern biographies.
Right.
They're the most recent, and they are all three drawn from Burton's personal papers, Isabel Burton, his wife's personal papers, from all the other scholars of, since he died, the intervening, Fawn Brody wrote hers in the 70s, and Edward Rice and Mary Lovell in the 90s. So we're talking, you know, what, 80 to 100 years of scholarship on Burton
yep.
and his own papers, which I discovered to my the pleasure or whatever you want to call
delight,
it. Delight. That kind of
happiness.
Thing, was that a chunk of his personal papers, of all places, are right over here at the Huntington.
Really now? Did
yes.
you go over there?
No, because the hoity-toity Huntington, you have to, what is it?
You must be a credentialed scholar with the...
Or you have to have two PhDs backing you up, and they must meet a criteria. Now, my two PhDs, you know who they are. And yeah. they were more than happy to back me up on this, but even they had to be members of the... The hoops that I had to jump through. But to their credit, I was able to do a database search.
Yeah.
On
whose credit?
Huntington.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, to the Huntington's credit, you know, I was able to do a database search. And between that and the historical scholarship that's available, I was able to pretty much get the answer. What I was looking for was one particular letter that he wrote to Albert Tootle, in which this is interesting now, shortly before he went on this little expedition where he the lost months in South America, he told Albert Tootle, who was a friend of he and his wife from the consulate, from the Foreign Office. I'm stomping my foot when I say from the Foreign Office, for those intel people who know what I'm talking about. He told Tootle that he was getting ready to go off on this trip. Tell no one.
I have another beer.
Yeah, he said to tell no one. To keep it to yourself.
Oh, yes, I remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this particular letter is
the funny thing, he was telling somebody that was not connected to the anything in any official capacity to what he was doing, sub rosa.
We don't know. Tootle,
you said probably not.
Tootle, I can't prove it. I still, there's a percentage that we don't know. I mean, here's the thing. He was in the Foreign Office. You know, it's very possible that the reason I argue that probably not is because, yes, the fact that he wrote this letter and said, don't tell anyone. And I think I lay out the argument pretty good as to why Albert Tootle would not have yeah. been an intel officer. Yeah. But I have to admit that I got to leave it open to some degree, because I wasn't able to prove it for sure right. that he was or was not. But because he would write what he wrote in the letter, if Tootle had been in on it as an intelligence personnel, there would have been no need for the letter, is my position. So, he's probably not – he was probably not one of them. But Burton felt like he – trusted him enough to say, hey, I'm going to be off, and this is something that you got to keep on the QT. Tootle went on to do literary stuff with Burton in the subsequent years and was a good friend of he and his wife. So.
Okay. Well, I think we should back up a little bit because we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, off into the weeds.
Yeah. The beginning of the book, you talk about his early life, what his family life was like, how his family mm-hmm. was moving around, went to different countries. His father was assigned to different places.
Right.
Because of his... was he working for the government or was it business stuff?
The father?
Yeah.
The father was a military officer.
Okay,
who,
so it was a government thing.
Yeah, well...
military.
He was a military officer who was...
And they lived all over Europe.
Off of... he was kind of on indefinite leave. I forget the term. It's in the book. Off the top of my head, I'm forgetting the term. But he was in kind of a state of limbo, primarily... because there had been some intrigue involving the prince regent at the time and his wife. And Burton's father, Joseph Burton, and some of the other younger officers were in, you know, the retinue of officers who I guess they were part of her security retinue or something. Anyway, they were loyal to the then princess. Would-be queen or whatever. And during the divorce proceedings, Joseph Burton refused to testify against Caroline. And because of that, the Prince Regent made sure his career was stunted. And he was on, you know, I guess a small stipend or whatever.
Right.
And because his wife, Richard Burton's mother, came from a family that had a little bit of money, they were able to move about with British expat upper crusters throughout Europe, specifically France and Italy. And this was, as the book states and as the biographers state, Joseph Burton was a gentleman in kind of that final era where you could make a profession out of being a gentleman, spending your time, you know, hunting and fishing and entertaining.
Discussing first editions and whatever.
Yes, things like that. But it is the interesting little comment in the Edward Rice biography of Burton in which he keeps He keeps referring to Burton's father as dabbling in chemistry. And that kind of caught my eye. And so I pulled that thread and I found, a father who dabbles in chemistry. And it just so happens that all the little places that he was dragging his two sons and his wife around and daughter throughout France and Italy happened to have a very rich history in alchemy.
Yes.
Isn't that interesting? And, of course, you know, when you put that together with what we know about Richard Francis Burton is that he was very much into esoteric things, and he was a Kabbalist, and he was into mystical religions and pursuits. You kind of begin to put together a picture of what his youth and childhood and what his influences were.
But when you say a philosopher scientist in – actually pulling from the tradition of alchemy, hermeticism,
yes,
Kabbalah, and all that, and trying to combine it with a scientific method.
Right, right. Well,
which actually, strangely enough, these other things are a scientific method, but in a different version, a different
exactly,
form.
Exactly. Here's the quick history of it. The Royal Society was founded by men who were Freemasons and these philosopher scientists that we're talking about. And they founded the Royal Society. These men were hermeticists and alchemists every bit as much as they were astronomers and mathematicians and the like.
Yeah, like Newton.
Newton was known to be even more of an alchemist than a mathematician, and you know, for a while there,
yeah,
in his lifetime. And yeah,
Paul brought that up in the last interview.
Yeah. So the men who founded the Royal Society. Coincidentally, most of these men were also involved in the foundation of Oxford University, where Burton ultimately attended. That these were, when we say philosopher scientists, you're absolutely right. These were the guys that were just as much into the esoteric stuff that the technician scientists, let's just say, do not appreciate.
Now.
And in 1830 – there was a rift in the Royal Society, and the rift was driven by politics. The king at the time of England wanted to put the final squash on the whole Stuart family claim and all that. So he had gotten control of the Royal Society to finally bury the documentation, any documentation that the Royal Society possessed that these philosopher scientists had put together that might have been argued by the Stuarts in support of the whole Stuart thing. Okay? You got to look at the history. It's all in there.
And it happens to be full of alchemy, occultism, hermeticism, etc.
Exactly. And so he got it – he wanted it squished. So what he did was he got the – technician scientists who really resented the philosopher scientists who had founded the organization. By 1830, these technician scientists who would be like today's, you know, atheist science geek weenies that, you know, are skeptical about everything. These would be the original versions of those knuckleheads. Anyway, by 1830, the technician science geeks outnumbered the philosopher scientists. And so they, at that point, they made it a regulation or law or whatever in the Royal Societies that
– oh, mumbo jumbo.
Yeah, you had to be a technician scientist to be an officer of the
Royal Society.
A member of the Royal Society. And the beauty about Burton – this is what cracks me up about Burton. He was a philosopher scientist to the core from the time he was a kid.
Right.
And yet he –
because of his background.
He won their admiration by being – as good, if not better, at their technician weenie geek thing than they were. He knew how to play them. So, you know, they standing ovations, they lauded him, blah, blah, blah. And yet he was his mentors and such. These were all the alchemists and guys like that, the Kabbalists.
Yeah.
That
were these people still at Oxford when he was there? That's my next question.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. I get into individuals, Varley. You'll have to excuse me. It's been. I'm already into the next.
Yes, I know. I mean, have you been interviewed and somebody says, "Remember when you wrote this?" And you're like, "Huh? What?
Has that happened to you?"
Oh, all the time.
Yeah, thank you.
I wrote that. I don't even remember.
I feel bad when that happens because people say people equate that with, "Oh, he doesn't know his stuff. See, the book's all bullshit." It's like, excuse me.
Yeah, Varley, tell me about some job you did 10 years. Well, even 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Tell me all the details of this job you did and what you did to complete this job.
Right.
That's what a book is like.
Yeah. You know, Burton at Oxford, it was brief, and I explore the possibility of why it was so brief.
Right.
And that's, again, folks, like Greg said, there's a lot of speculation in this book, and I am upfront about it.
Yes.
I state, as a matter of fact, chapter 7 in the first paragraph, I say everything from this point forward.
And then... at chapter 7, and then a couple times after, you're like, I know this is going to drive you crazy. It's going to drive some of you crazy, but follow me here. We're just having fun.
Because this is all we got.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing
for now
that has come up. Nothing has emerged. So, at Oxford, there were these gentlemen who were Kabbalists and got Burton into the Kabbalah. And he was introduced to scholars like... Abraham Ablafia, who...
That's a weird name.
Of Saragossa. And...
What's that, Spain?
Yes. Oh. And that I get into a little bit how... Ablafia inspired a Polish writer in the early... late 18th century, early 19th century, named Jan Potocki. Jan Potocki was an adventurer himself. In fact, Jan Potocki... was very similar to Richard Burton's father, Joseph. Very interesting parallels there. I don't know how many of you, there's probably some of you out there that are familiar with a film called The Saragossa Manuscript. If you are a Grateful Dead fan, you should recognize it because it was apparently Jerry Garcia's favorite movie. Jerry Garcia was very instrumental with Martin Scorsese in bringing The Saragossa Manuscript to DVD in a film restoration. Garcia, I think, was responsible for bringing it to screenings. And Scorsese, I think, is the one responsible for it. But if you have not seen this film, get your hands on it if you like these, hermetic, esoteric kinds of things. Anyway, Ablafia was very... influential on Jan Potocki. And the reason I'm mentioning all this is Potocki wrote the book, the manuscript found in Saragossa, which the film we're talking about is based upon. Its structure is a lot like The Arabian Nights. It's episodic, and yet there's a thread that ties all this together. What's interesting is this book was published, Potocki could only get it published in French, in France, it would have been around during Burton's youth. I think it was published in 1812 and then in 1815, the final version. Burton, 10 years later, 15 years later, when Burton was a kid going around Europe, this would have been something that he very easily, might have read. In my book, I go into why this book, Manuscript Found in Saragossa, and Abraham Ablafia is important because we know for a fact that Burton read Ablafia's works at Oxford. That's a matter of record.
Okay. So to push forward with the
–
because the main thread in this is that Burton was a member of a secret society.
Mm-hmm.
You guess.
I suspect strongly that he was recruited into a secret hermetic society or was recruited by them to be their field agent while he was at Oxford, yes.
Right. Were there any things like that going on at Oxford besides what Burton might have been a member of? Are there a secret you don't know?
According to my sources, who both are Oxford PhDs and very much into these things, a resounding yes. when I went to them for research, you know, as sources, they were gleeful when they received my questions, and I asked them, "Hey guys, was there any? Or to your knowledge?" And it was like, "Where do I begin?" You know, each of them. So, according to these two sources. Again, PhDs of Oxford. Yes, the answer is yes, that it's very, very possible.
Okay. You also mentioned the British East India Company.
Mm-hmm.
Was Burton working for them?
Oh, he was a commissioned officer in the British East India.
For people that don't
know. He left Oxford to accept the commission.
Okay, right. No wonder my question came next.
Yeah.
For people that don't know what that is, what was the British East India Company? Because we know the Dutch East India Company was when the Dutch were going around the world,
right,
and exploring things and trying to get a monopoly. What was the British East India Company, and was it private?
Yes.
Okay. How do you be an officer in a private enterprise?
Well,
and is there my other part of the question, which I thought would be interesting, is there any
modern parallel?
Modern parallel? Yes exactly. To something like the British East India.
Yes, there is, and I'll get to that after I explain.
Because you didn't say anything about that in the book, but I thought that would be interesting.
Well, I didn't want to because that.
No, you just go off. On
yeah,
a tangent,
that so. That will send people off on a tangent because even though there is a modern example, I want to say that actually it's a night and day thing. And I do not want to leave an impression that they are actually the same, but
just as an example to help understand what they did.
The British East India Company was a private entity that was contracted solely by the British government to provide military protection for their interests in India, in the frontier, as it was known. They established their own military, and they had ranks, of course. Burton given a commission, because that's how they did it in those days.
So it was a private paramilitary organization,
exactly like Blackwater.
Yeah,
I don't want to invoke that because I don't want to go off on a tangent.
Right,
but Blackwater is an example, kind of.
Yeah, what's the big one out at Area 51?
But Blackwater was East India
Hutt,
Company.
Something like that.
What's that?
Wackenhut.
Yeah, these contract entities. But that's where the similarity mostly ends, pretty much. You know, there's no rank structure in the modern organizations. But, of course, you know, British East India Company, Burton accepts a commission. And off he goes to India. Now, those periods of his life are well documented. What I get in the degree to which I get into his time in India, his time in Arabia and Africa, is to reflect upon my thesis of his having been already recruited by a hermetic organization to be following their taskings while out there with the East India Company. Oh, and let me go back. He was. He accepted the commission in the East India Company because of his amazing, phenomenal natural ability with linguistics. He was trained in multiple languages, and they immediately put him into intelligence. They trained him as a surveyor to do survey, and he did. He was a legitimate surveyor. He participated in doing survey to build a railroad and bridges and things like that. However, that training was given to him primarily as a cover for his intelligence duties, which is what they really took him for, was to make him an intelligence officer. So he was the classic intelligence officer with the survey cover. The British like to use survey. They did it with Colonel Fawcett, and I get into that a little bit later. And while he was doing this for the British government, he was also, he was also doing intelligence collections for the Hermetic Organization on the evidence and remnants lost civilizations, lost cities.
Why do the hermetic societies want to know? This is obvious for most people listening, but why do they want to know about lost civilizations, about their ideas about reality, and maybe what they did?
Here's the thing. These hermetic organizations, it's part of the tradition to accept, believe in the idea that there was there were multiple civilizations possessing advanced technology.
And
every bit as advanced as are in philosophy and all that, and they've been forgotten to the masses through time, but the secret societies and such, they've had pieces of evidence of this. And so they've long been in pursuit of finding the smoking gun, as it were, of finding the actual lost, forgotten city that where some of this advanced technology may still exist, or at least some of the apparatus, so that they can, quite frankly, reverse engineer it. You know, even though we're talking a couple hundred years ago, or throughout the last several hundred years, they've always wanted to reverse engineer the concept.
Also the personal esoteric,
yes,
you know, furtherance of making people into superhuman, whatever you want to call it.
Exactly.
Better functioning human beings.
That gets into the whole, the transhumanism thing and all that. So this is what they're about. So therefore, that's why Burton, I present in the book, was the perfect candidate to be recruited to be looking for these lost cities specifically through his knowledge of linguistics. And I always get it mixed up, ethnology. Versus ethnography, ethnology, whatever.
Yeah.
And anthropology, I think, is the big catch-all word we use now for that. And and physically looking for the actual physical lost cities, which is, you know, what the book is really all about. That's basically what I argue he was doing while with the East India Company.
Okay. Wow, we've filled up 40 minutes with this, and I've got a few. I've got something that was mentioned in the book, but doesn't specifically have to do with Burton. Well, kind of does have to do with Burton, the Spiro Mounds thing in Oklahoma.
Oh, okay.
Why don't you describe what that is?
Well, and
then I'll ask you the question about.
I'm only as versed.
This
as,
is one of the mound complexes that are all over, especially I guess east of the Mississippi.
And my extent of knowledge is what's in the book, so I'm not really an expert on that. But basically, you know, those of you who are familiar with the mystery of the mound cultures, I'm one of those who doesn't buy that it was just more Native American stuff. No, there's evidence that these were people from other parts of the world, ancient Europe, Middle East, that kind of thing, who came to North America, and they are actually the mound culture, the original mound culture. And the Spiro Mounds have the evidence there of the lost civilization. Possibly of the lost civilization. Argue.
The thing that was actually fascinating.
But even the park ranger.
Yeah. You said, David, talk to the park ranger.
Yeah.
And he said, because there was he asked him about a giant skeleton with a copper armor.
Yeah, copper armor. And even David Childress, he went there and he.
That had been found there.
Yeah, he writes that he talked to the park ranger and the park ranger said, yeah, that was taken by the Smithsonian.
When?
I believe David went there in the late 80s, early 90s is when the park ranger told him that. So, you know what, I can't remember when the giant skeleton was allegedly found. It might have been when they first did.
Because in a more modern time, I don't think it wouldn't have been as easy for the Smithsonian to say, we know all about that. We need that in our archives.
I don't know. I think if they could get away with it, they'd do it today. Why do we think? I mean, if they were trying to cover this stuff up in the past, the consensus history model. It's what it is. The consensus history model is pushed.
I'm asking because I want you to pontificate.
Yeah, and that's folks. I'm a diffusionist. I do not buy into the consensus history model. you know, I'm a speculator. Okay, we know that. If you don't know it, learn it. That's just the way it is. Accept it when you are when you're reading my books and you're listening to me talk. That's just me. Okay.
It took me a while.
Yeah.
just to calm down. It's like Walter is speculating here. It's okay. Yeah.
And I admit
we're not
that
trying
this
to change the
bullshit.
World, and we're not trying to tell people you people are full of shit, and we're not.
Right. And when I say I admit this could all be bullshit, let me rephrase that. I'm not saying this could all be a bunch of crap I'm making up. What I'm saying is I could be wrong. You know,
but here's some interesting
evidence in support of why I think what I do. But what I thought was interesting about that story that David tells is that a park ranger would even make a comment like that.
Yeah.
Because, you know,
without smirking, I hope.
Well, the indication I got from reading it is that the guy was sympathetic towards, you know, David's position.
Ah.
And because they usually are they're professional folks.
Yeah, you know, they understand toe the line.
Yeah, they understand what their jobs are. Their jobs are not to proselytize to any idea. You know, they just present, here it is. Here's what scientists or history thinks. You know, you decide. So that's an interesting little anecdote in, you know, the modern research on those mounds.
Okay, well, it also
the reason it's important is because speculate that of the places in North America Burton would have seen on his mysterious
sojourn,
unwritten about sojourn through the southeastern United States in 1860, the Spiro Mounds might have been one of the sites he would have been very much interested in.
What was going on? Why did he come over to the United States in 1860?
Should we jump to that, or did you have stuff in between?
No, we should jump to that, because my next thing after that has to do with Salt Lake City. And,
yes. Okay.
And then into Manuscript 512.
When I read that Burton had been in South America for, you know, the 3 years, and that 6 months were unwritten about, that made me go, huh? What? And then as I dug deeper and I found out that he had come to the United States in 1860, folks, that's the year before the Civil War, and there was a period in which he went into the South that is also a mystery and undocumented, much shorter than the South American period. But still, you know, when you know anything about Civil War history, most people who look at it know that there was some tacit British approval of the Confederacy for obvious reasons. You know, and maybe we can get our colonies back, get them resources. But because the slavery issue, quite frankly, the British people,
unpopular in Europe.
That's right. The British people were kind of vocal to the crown, like, no, you won't back this Confederate States. No, uh-uh. However, there were certain elites in England that were very much interested in the Confederacy, you know, coming out on top. And knowing all that, you wonder, gee, here's this British agent. You know, he's already got British intelligence. Remember, when he was an intelligence officer, that hooked him up with British intelligence, not just with the East India Company in India. So here was a British intelligence officer who's over in the United States the year before Civil War breaks out.
Walter, and let me eat all the goodies.
That's okay. He disappears into the South, and we don't know what he was doing. Okay, and certain people in England were interested in the Confederacy winning. You know, you get the point I'm trying to make here.
Right.
Was he there delivering a message or information? You know, was he meeting with Jefferson Davis or anybody in his cabinet and so forth?
No record of him doing any of that stuff.
No record at all. That's the thing.
But a record that he was in the South. Oh, but he made it to New Orleans, so at least he was in part of the
South.
We
know that he was in New Orleans, and then he reappears in Missouri. Now, here's the interesting thing.
Another place with a lot of mound.
Yeah, here's
complexes.
The interesting thing that the book explains. Here's the problem with sending Burton as the agent to be the go-between between British elites and the Confederacy. Burton had a very strong anti-slavery position. Burton was no more fond of slavery than the British people. So he would not have been the guy. But it just so happens that I learned that in the course of this research that Burton went to the United States with a very good buddy of his, an old friend, John Steinhauser, about which very little is known, and much is very hard to find. And I argue that he, in the book, goes into why a little bit more detail. I argue that it was Steinhauser who was on this trip with him through the United States and into the South. Steinhauser, interestingly, does not appear, emerge with Burton in Missouri. So Steinhauser leaves once Burton leaves the South. Steinhauser is no longer on the trip.
Yeah, he was with him in, what, New York and D.C.?
All the way through New England, from Nova Scotia down through New England.
So they landed in Halifax there, Paul.
Yes, Kimball. Paul, if you're listening. And so I think that if anybody was the agent, the go-between, I think it was Steinhauser, and I explain why in the book, go into detail, but I think it was more Steinhauser. I think Burton's reason for going to the United States was what he did after he emerged in Missouri.
Walter, what did he do after this?
His trip to Utah.
Why the hell would Sir Richard Francis Burton want to go to Utah and then, as you say in the book, meet twice with Brigham Young, who was still alive then, obviously.
And all his top cronies. Here's the thing. We all joke about the Mormons.
And this is a historical fact.
He did meet with them. Yeah, he wrote, good God, he wrote painfully extensively on his sojourn in Utah. And I think there was a...
But he didn't write about what they talked about.
That's right.
Go ahead.
That's right. Here's the thing. We joke about Mormons. We joke about Mormonism. Here's the thing that I have found, okay? And I stand by this. Whatever you think of Mormonism and Mormon scripture and the Mormon religion, let me tell you something. I'm convinced that they know something accurate about ancient civilizations in the Americas. Here's my position, and I state it in the book. I am convinced that Joseph Smith indeed found a record of the lost civilizations in the ancient Americas. And I am convinced equally that then he used that information and plagiarized it into what we know as the Book of Mormon. I don't put stock in the Book of Mormon beyond whatever details he lifted from these ancient records. But, yeah, I do think he found ancient record of a lost civilization.
Where would he find that, and why do you think that?
His story is that he found the golden plates in the hill Cumorah in upstate New York.
You know, and, near what, Palmyra, I think?
Yeah, and then he returned them. I don't believe that. I'll go on record right now. I say it in the book. I don't think he returned those plates. I think he kept them. I think those plates are held in a vault in Salt Lake to this day. And I think that Burton's reason for going to Utah, for going to Salt Lake, was to learn what he could about this and possibly see them from the Mormons, from the Mormon leadership there. Because Burton, by this time...
Because Mormons weren't very popular at that point either.
Oh, my gosh, no. Remember, there was the whole massacre story. Yeah,
they were considered wackos.
Yeah, and, they were a territory, and there was going to be war against them.
Yeah, why the hell was Burton there?
I think, which one of the... One of... one of the famous generals was going to be in charge of...
Custer?
No, not Custer. Anyway, was all part of that.
Well, they were trying to expand westward. In fact, they tried to take over San Francisco, and when they got there, apparently, Bill Moore told me this. The Mormons sailed into San Francisco Bay,
uh-huh.
And they were going to take the fort.
Yeah.
Or take the
Presidio.
City, the Presidio, and they saw an American flag on it, and they went, damn it! I think they were like a few days late. Because they wanted to start on the west and then build back their territory to
Utah. Yeah, well,
Utah.
Even if they decide to take it on, I think you're
out of inside knowledge years ago that something like this happened.
What's that?
An exchange did take place, but never that anybody came back.
What is that?
I don't know why, but for no reason, because I didn't touch my computer, the Serpo show from Art Bell from 2005 suddenly popped up.
Okay. That was odd.
Part one of four of the show on Serpo from 2005.
Oh, God. Just what I need. Somebody's going to say, yeah, see if Serpo pops up. That's a mysterious way to show that Walter's full of – oh, God. Anyway, I think if the Mormons –
sorry about that.
I think if the Mormons would have sailed into San Francisco, the kind of guys that were in San Francisco in those days would have said, like hell, you ain't closing our saloons and whorehouses.
Yeah.
No way. San Franciscans would not have gone
there.
Anyway, for that.
Yeah. What the hell was he doing there? Why would he even go there? And what?
I'm convinced that he went. Here's the thing.
And what do you think they talked about?
He was, by this time.
Well, you can guess from what we were just talking about. But.
By this time, I think Burton had already learned information and heard the stories about something going on in South America, because the stories had been making their way back to Europe, documented from the days of the Spanish conquest. So for 400 to 300, a little over 300 years, 300 to 400 years by this time, am I doing my math right? Yeah. Yeah. 1400s to the 1500s, to the 1800s, a little over 300 years, you know, these stories have been coming back of these interesting places that had been found by then. Remember, Machu Picchu and Pumapunku and this stuff allegedly wasn't known, you know, in 1860. And however, there were stories coming back of El Dorado and all this. So Burton, I think, was already directly on the trail of the lost civilization in South America. Mm-hmm. And having become aware of what Joseph Smith's writings and what the Mormon beliefs were, I think he went to Salt Lake to meet with Brigham Young and to meet with the leaders there who might give him access to this information. I would venture to say that he might have had the same suspicion I have, that the plates are right there in the vault, the most important, deepest vault in Salt Lake. And he wanted to see them if he could.
Because of his expertise with languages?
Because of his expertise with languages and ancient history.
I'd have to actually find out if anybody's ever looked at, you know, because they have supposedly, I've got an old Book of Mormon that actually has a gold cover with the actual supposed writing on it. And you have the same thing, yes, illustrated in the book.
In the book.
And it looks exactly like the piece that I have. It would be interesting to get somebody who is a cipher person or a language person to look at that and see if there was a
–
because sometimes there's a one-to-one relationship with English, which probably means it's fake.
Right. But I think this has been looked at so much that
It might have been. Who knows?
Found yet. But
because it is a script – this is an area I'm interested in. It is a script – writing, not a pictorial form of writing.
It's very what
and if it was
about,
made up, it's really hard for people to make up a language without trying to, you know, give it a. It's not an ideological. I mean, what is ideographical language? It's a alphabetical language. It looks like an alphabetical language.
Yeah, but the characters are, you know, they look. You might at a glance say, "Oh, it's kind of Cyrillic," but it's actually very similar to what George Gist, also known as Sequoyah, the famous Cherokee scholar, who I am a descendant of. That's a matter of record. Sequoyah was the Cherokee who is credited with first writing their language, and the characters are similar to that. Which is interesting in itself. There's something about this. The reason I focused on this, I mean, there's obvious reasons why.
Sorry, I pulled you down a path here. So
here's the thing. One thing I did not mention in the book, because I'll be mentioning it elsewhere in subsequent work, is the script was suspiciously and deliciously similar to the mysterious characters and alphabet used by Charles Delshow in the Aero Club documentation.
Oh, you see, you didn't say that in the book.
That's right. I didn't say it in
That's
the book.
That's nice.
I didn't want to go there in the book.
Yeah.
Yet, because I am – here's the thing. These Secret Missions books and the Empire of the Wheel books, they are pieces of a big picture.
Yes, that was one of my questions.
I've been putting together on the emergence of the breakaway civilizations in the 19th century, which, by the way, we'll come back to this later. I'm giving a presentation on all this in Bastrop, Texas, on October 31st at the Secret Space Program Conference.
What a great time to have a conference!
Yeah, absolutely, Halloween weekend, but
Halloween actually.
Yes, on Halloween Day. Yeah. But, yeah, this would have been the stuff that would have intrigued the hell out of Burton. And then I got into, in pursuing this, to answer your question further or to continue
on. Yeah, why
this,
was there and what did they talk about?
What's interesting is in the Book of Mormon, it identifies these cities by name. And we'll later get into how this ties into Colonel Fawcett, which is
okay, I didn't
kind
have
of an eye-opener.
Yeah, Colonel Fawcett question. Oh, so, but the point is that the reason that he went there, your speculation is, and he didn't kick him out or say anything. In fact, he saw him twice.
He stayed for 3 weeks, and yeah, he got along. Brigham Young admired – he liked Burton. He was intimately familiar with his works, with his own explorations.
Yeah, you said he could actually pinpoint on a map where he had been.
Exactly.
Of Africa.
Exactly. It was known because Brigham Young himself was, you know, a frontiersman and that kind of thing. So there was that kind of – they got along because they were kind of cut from the same cloth. They were tough men. Say what you want about Brigham Young. He was a frontiersman. He was a, you know, he's a tough cookie, okay. And he was a practical man. He was, as even the leader of the Mormons, he was more down to earth and practical than you might think.
I guess he'd have to be. But yeah, the point was they had the reason he wanted to talk to him was that he had possible, or the records had possible knowledge of some of this
lost
civilization and cities that
yeah,
Burton was after.
Exactly. And yeah, and I'm convinced that's why Burton came to the United States, was to go to Utah. That was his primary motivator. Mm. And that was why he went to Salt Lake and spent the – and I think that in that time he got something. He got something.
Is that why his accounting of it is so damned boring?
Oh my God! Yes, yeah. I think that
nobody would want to read it after a certain point.
His publisher was always willing to publish, you know, any book he wrote on his travels. So that was a habit he got into, and a practice he got into because, you know, he still needed to make a living. You know, wanted to make a little extra money. So, you know, he would commit to I'll write a book about it. But and I read this book. His book on being in Utah, and oh my God, it was excruciating. It gets into the accounting of growing beans and cows and you know what people do on Saturday afternoon. I mean, it just, oh my God. And I think it was just, he knew, you know, he was just filling pages so that he could meet a publishing obligation, but yet there was no way in hell he was going to get into why he was there, because as I argue in the book, this whole thing about searching for the lost city was, you know, not just for the secret hermetic organization, it was for British intelligence.
Yeah. There was no railroad there yet, was there?
No, 1860. Because yeah, remember, I think it was 1876.
Post-Civil War was when the Promontory Point, Utah, yeah,
all that stuff. So they were doing it old-fashioned style, horseback, wagons, that kind of thing.
Stagecoaches, whatever the hell.
He took a stagecoach from Missouri to Salt Lake.
Yeah.
And he was disappointed that they weren't attacked by wild Indians. He was all ready for it. He was hoping, you know, where's the wild Indians? And, you know, the Indians are kind of like, what's your problem, bub? We're just out here scraping out a living, you know?
Leave us alone.
Yeah. I mean, there had actually been some type of altercation with the natives, but it was it didn't catch up to them. They got away.
Because apparently they did not get along well with the Mormons either.
Right.
For different reasons.
Right. And so on he went from Salt Lake to San Francisco, where he spent a little bit of time. It's fun to wonder if he made it over Yosemite Way to Sonora.
Yes, you mentioned that.
Because the Sonora Air Club, as you've heard me talk about before, if you read in my other books and the works of Michael Busby or Dennis Crenshaw and the like,
yeah,
that the Sonora Air Club was over there flying their little machines for the NIMSA in the 1850s. So in 1860, you know, certainly they would still be around. Did Burton, while he was in the Bay Area, go visit them? We don't know.
A couple days trip?
He was there for 10 days.
Okay.
We drive to Sacramento from San Francisco in, what, 2 hours?
Yeah, so
and
I then said it probably would have taken a couple
Sonora's
of days.
2 hours from Sacramento driving, so yeah.
Oh, so about probably more like 4 days.
Yeah, so
you booked it, maybe
it would have been almost half his time.
Yeah.
There, but you know, we don't know. That's just a fun, you know, let's not go too far on that.
Then he got on a boat and went down through
Central America and Panama and spent some time there. little bit of time, and then he got involved in other aspects of his career, and finally, in 1865, he gets a consulship in Brazil, and that's where the fun starts.
All right, what is Manuscript 512? Oh. Why is it important to our understanding of why Burton may have gone to South America, besides being assigned to the consulate?
Manuscript 512. As you know, you've read the book. That yes. The chapter in which I discuss that is titled The Smoking Gun.
And thank you, Walter, for discussing everything I asked instead of saying, you have to read the book for that. Because the thing is, if people are intrigued enough, they're going to read the damn book.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. Oh, and I'm still leaving enough good stuff in the book. Right. That's the thing. This book has so much in it that I can talk about it, and yet still I'm not... You know, there's still good stuff in it. Right. Manuscript.
I'm just trying to give listeners an idea of what the story is, what the motivation was, what evidence, if there was any, and what the speculation is, and why the speculation and where it might lead. Right. So let's continue.
Okay. Manuscript 512 is really the central hub, the crux of all this big-ass speculation I've done with this book. It is the smoking gun. And I will tell you what was exciting about the research on this is – Manuscript 512 is not where the idea for this book began. As I told you, the idea for this book began with, what do you mean Burton was in South America for 6 months where all this cool stuff is and we don't know what he was doing? When I discovered his connection to Manuscript 512, it was initially in one of David's books, and it was almost just a throwaway comment. And my jaw dropped. My jaw dropped. I was just like, oh my God.
What statement? I'm sorry.
Here's I'll get to that. Let me set it up nicely because the book does it in the same way.
Yes.
Manuscript 512 was the report of a Portuguese officer in command of an expedition looking for mining resources in the Minas Gerais area of Brazil, the jungle area. In the heart of Brazil and in the jungles and such. And the sources say they had been assigned these duties for like a decade, for 10 years. When.
Geez, sounds like a Cabeça de Vaca.
Yeah. And.
Actually, when I read the story, it did sound like that.
Yeah. So at one point in this mission that they have, this overall mission they have, they become lost for quite a while in the jungle, and they come across this amazing city that they don't recognize it's not a recognizable civilization. There is a language, there are words, there's a language engraved in the architecture. There's some damage to the city. It looks like, between Earth, planetary cataclysm and some type of destruction, that these towers look like they had been struck by lightning. They were blackened. It was just this weird city they found that was abandoned, except for they did find skeletons and some corpses in one area. But... I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. The manuscript itself was the report of the discovery of this city, of this Portuguese patrol, after they returned to Rio de Janeiro, emerged back to civilization.
When?
In 1753. So the commander writes this report, which is Manuscript 512. He files it with his superiors, and they file it away. And the going back to what they found, the document describes in detail this city they found, and kind of a description of where they found it, but just vague enough. And the argument is that would have been part of even more classified information.
Is there any way to tell whether that was a real document done by real people or just a story?
It has been authenticated.
Okay.
It has been authenticated because it laid in their files in Rio de Janeiro for about 86 years. And in 1839, it was dug up by a
But the only reference to it is itself?
What do you mean the only reference?
Meaning there's nobody else on the expedition that said anything.
That's right. That's right.
This
That's
was
right.
a real person yeah. That, yeah. that wrote the manuscript.
Oh, yeah.
The
people they talk there's about a photo of the manuscript in the book.
Right.
This is a real authenticated manuscript. It was written in 1753 yeah. and filed.
Meaning I don't think – it wasn't written as a hoax, a tease, a diversion, no, anything
was
like that.
It was an official report. Done.
Okay. All right.
And in 1839, it reemerges when they're doing a inventory, and they go, "Hey, what's this?" And they say, of course, "Oh, gee, darn! Part of it is worm eaten, and the chunks. There's kind of a big chunk out of it, and you know, you got to wonder. Okay, this is maybe where the information being a little, you know, pinpointing where it's at a little bit more or whatever, you know, you can speculate there with, yeah. you know, in a lot of fun ways. It was, you know, hold on a second. I lost my train of thought there. It reemerges in 1839, but it's not translated into English. And I don't know how. There's nothing in the story as to how it got disseminated or how anyone in England learned about it. But somebody my understanding is there is a vague understanding that somebody who was connected with the British learned about it while in Brazil and got a copy of it to England. And it was translated into English for the first time in July of 1865, and that translation was in the hands of Sir Richard Francis Burton in August or September of 1865 when he sailed for Brazil. And what's interesting is the first English translation of manuscript 512 was done by none other than Isabel Burton, his wife. Now,
Credited to.
It's credited to her. I argue that there might be the possibility of that Richard himself translated the document and credited her, or he greatly assisted her. But here's the thing. Isabel Burton is credited to the first English translation of manuscript 512, which is a story of a lost ancient city
right.
With a strange language written on it. And it's in the hands of Richard Burton when he sails to Brazil in 1865.
For his posting.
Yeah, he goes there for his consular posting. Exactly, yeah, to Brazil. And the interesting thing is while he's there, the first couple of years that he's there, he does a lot of exploration. He even writes a book titled Explorations in the Highlands of Brazil. Now, the funny thing about this book is in Exploration of the Highlands of Brazil, he is all over the same territory that this patrol in 1753 that wrote manuscript 512, he's all over that same territory. But in the book, he doesn't say a word about the lost city or looking for it or anything about the manuscript, except funny thing.
How do you know he had the manuscript with him when he left then?
Because his wife translated it.
Oh, okay.
And in the funny thing in the book, he includes his wife's English translation, the first English translation, as an appendix in the book.
Although he doesn't talk about it.
But he doesn't talk about it in the text. So there he is all over the exact same territory, folks. The exact same territory in Minas Gerais. Okay? The exact same places, right? Even in some cases by name other than, you know. But there's no reference to this lost city of 1753, which had come to be referred to as, or manuscript 512, but he includes manuscript 512 itself, the English translation, it as an appendix in his book, Explorations in the Highlands of Brazil. Now, we could sit here and argue with somebody all day and bicker back and forth and Let me tell you something. The man who is who he is, he goes to Brazil. His wife is the one who translates this document for the first time in English about a lost city. He goes there. He explores the same exact region, every inch of it. He includes the manuscript about the lost city as an appendix in the book he writes about it. Folks, I'm telling you, the reason I call the chapter about manuscript 512 the smoking gun is because, damn it, it is the smoking gun as to my argument that he was definitely looking for this lost city while he was there. Now, the speculation arises, where did he find it? Did he get there? To what extent did he go looking for it? But the whole manuscript 512 issue and its connection to him, when you look at his background that I provided up to that chapter, you know, I provide all that. And then when you make that manuscript 512 connection.
Yeah, I think that was a part of the book that it compelled me the most, because it's like, this seems very possible.
It's supposed to be that compelling point.
Throw away the on a mission for whoever or a secret society or whatever.
Oh, no. It's like I see what you're saying.
Yeah. If you throw away all that stuff, this question still remains of just exactly what you just said.
Yeah.
And you can and did speculate off of that. But the thing was, it's just like, to my mind, that's why I said I'm getting this part that's the most interesting to me.
Yeah. And that's why I went ahead and had the balls to title that chapter The Smoking Gun. I decided, you know, I'm going to have fun with this because that's what I think it is. That's what I think it is. And again, I want to emphasize to all the acerbic, sourpuss, effeminate naysayers out there.
Effeminate?
Yeah, because... Well, that's part
of Walter Carr.
That's part of my philosophy of, you know, the whole bickering, got to be contrary to everything. It's like, guys, you've been married too long or something.
Or got to be right.
Yeah, you got to be right, because that's a real feminine trait. No offense, ladies. You know what I'm talking about. You know, so that whole bickering, got to
be right is a very male thing, too. Hence all
okay,
the
yeah, that. But the bickering aspect.
Yes.
You know, anyway. Yeah, you're right. The got to be right thing is a well... baser males that haven't been enlightened. Yeah, sports fans.
people on internet chat rooms,
yeah.
Blogs and things like that.
Yeah, they got to be writers. But anyway, here's the thing. Manuscript.
I'm right, and you're not. That yeah, means I'm better than you. So that's why I'm doing this.
Yeah, manuscript 512. Like it or not, you know, pretty much says yes. Damn it, Burton was looking for the lost city. In South America, you know. And I admit, everything from there is, let's have fun. Let's speculate from here, folks.
Yeah.
You know, we know what his background was. We've got this. We got the manuscript. I mean, he was there. He had the motive. You know, he was in the right place. And we have this big missing chunk of time. Come on.
Yeah.
Tell me what he was doing.
Of course, my favorite part of this was the stuff about the tunnels, because we hadn't. Remember years ago, mm-hmm. what, 6-8 years ago?
Something like that.
You were saying, I want to have an expedition down there, and I want to go. Because Dave Childress had been there and been down one of
yep.
these incredibly bizarre, very well-constructed tunnels that run around in the mountains in the Andes. But the mountains of Brazil.
I had two guys who when I was in Afghanistan, they were former.
These are not mentioned anywhere. The only time I've ever heard them mentioned, well, I haven't looked them up, but it was from you.
The tunnels?
Yeah.
Well, they're talked about quite a bit. The problem is part of the tunnel stuff comes from Blavatsky. And
oh, right. Well, that automatically makes people turn away.
As a source, she
a lot
is
of people.
Highly questionable is the polite way to put it. As I found out, I tried to give her the benefit of the doubt, and I painstakingly, her and Wilkins, Harold T. Wilkins, God bless him.
1950s writer on The Unexplained and Weird
yeah,
Things.
Yeah, and he presents a lot of good info. I'm not trashing Wilkins. I'm not doubting Wilkins
like
I doubt
Blavatsky.
I think
he wrote a couple UFO books, too, actually.
The problem with Wilkins is he doesn't provide his sources, as he should. He didn't. And there was the whole issue of trying to confirm some stuff with the tunnels and Blavatsky stuff. That it's just
yeah,
I just couldn't do it.
That's fine, but there are tunnels that that
because
do
David's
exist.
Been to one. Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely,
and it was huge. And
yeah, I had a couple of guys who were former Navy SEALs who were familiar with this kind of stuff when I was in Afghanistan, and I talked to them about it, and they were gung ho. They said, "Hell yeah, here's our info back home. Contact us. You know, we'll be part of this expedition." And Dave actually, he told me that he pitched it as part of an idea to a BBC series at the time that was courting him, and then you know they went in a different direction, and you know
that makes such a great. If you had the money behind that to do a TV thing like you were trying to do,
yeah.
You could do it. It would be amazing.
We were closer than you think to getting the backing. And what we were going to do was take
our
team.
I told you I'd go.
Yeah.
I would go in a heartbeat.
Greg was in on it. We were going to take our team.
What is this tunnel, and what did Dave see?
Okay.
Just to reiterate with people that don't know.
Dave went to the tunnel that you can access at South Sao Tome das Letras. In some cases, Sao Tomas das Letras. But I think properly it's Sao Tome. And the story that Dave was told was that a Brazilian army patrol had explored for 4 days into this tunnel, and they came into a larger chamber with three more tunnels going off of it deeper into the mountains, the earth, or whatever.
Yeah, okay, yeah, four including the one they came down.
But, yeah, including the one, four total, and then they turned around there because of supplies and logistics and stuff.
How long did it take them to get there?
4 days. 4 days.
They walked for 4 days underground.
Yeah.
Yeah.
According to the story.
Yeah, whether you believe that or not, Dave walked for a few kilometers.
Dave said, yeah, like 4 hours, I think, is what he told me. When he told me this. Dave told me, I first learned the story from Dave
personally.
And the
thing's like 9 feet high, so you don't have to bend over or
yeah, 9 feet high. And the way he described it was the average size 6 foot man could stand with his arms out to his sides, raised up.
And these were lined with rocks?
Flat rocks. It was smooth. It was smooth. It wasn't lined with – it wasn't like tiled with rocks or anything. It was just smooth through the – and now, he did say some of it was like a dirt surface.
Yeah.
But its construction was so not typical of
– yeah, didn't he say that there were wooden posts and then like a lintel of rocks or something over that?
I don't think I included that in my book, but that might be part of.
Anyway, it was very easy to walk down this tunnel without having bumping your head or anything.
He went 4 hours into it, he and two of his buddies, and then it started to descend deeper, and that was the point that they said, we'd love to go farther, but we're not, and right. They turned around and came back, and that's the one that he said, I've always wanted to go back there, and that's the one we were gonna go the 4 days into the larger room, or to see,
yeah,
if we could find the larger room.
Because you have to stop and camp in this damn tunnel.
Yeah, and think of the possible dangerous wildlife that's in there. Think of the natural gases,
yeah.
And there's all sorts of hazards and dangers.
Yeah.
To this,
I'll go.
But yeah, I was ready. Let's got to die of something. That's what I say to my buddy author Sesh Hari, and sometimes to Joseph Farrell. I've said that it's like, hey, you got to die of something. When I get some harebrained thing I want to do, and they're saying, be careful, be cautious. I'm like, balls out. Let's go do it. And in the book, I go into the possibility that if Burton explored any of these tunnel stories, he was all over Sao Tome das Letras. It's in his writings. So I argue and point out why he would have himself explored this tunnel, or this tunnel might have been part of this secret lost expedition. As we said, once, as Greg has read and as I'm saying, I argue with the book, when I provide the background foundation of who he was and what he was into and who he was involved with, and then you bring it up to manuscript 512, which is kind of a big aha, then, it's really fun to speculate what he might have been doing in that missing time.
Yeah.
So
after this, it wasn't even documented he was doing anything till he showed up in Lima, right?
Right.
What
happened was he went to Buenos Aires, and he spent a couple of months there, I believe, establishing a very distinct cover of being an old has-been who was drunk half the time and kind of like half off his nut, with a hair trigger on his pistol. And I argue that he was establishing a cover because he was a master at cover.
When he was doing intelligent works.
He's famous for that.
Yeah.
He's one of the guys who I think he was the first one to do exactly what he did, where he went on the Hajj and went into Mecca and saw the Kaaba.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like the first to come out and say, it's just a meteor rock. he was the first one to reveal that it's just, what they called an aerolite back then. And he did this and lived, okay? he was. You can read about Richard Burton and all the biographies of what a master of undercover disguise and such that he was. So I argue that this persona, even though he was being Richard Burton, it was a persona that matched what was known to be in the South American wilderness. A bunch of scalawags, a bunch of outlaw acting kind of rough and tumble, you know, quick to draw kind of murderous thugs. Well, he had to establish that he was just as murderous and lethal as the best of them or the worst of them. And I think that that's what he was doing before he disappeared into the Brazilian wilderness jungles with
those two
Ignacio
guys.
Rickard.
Yeah.
And, oh my gosh, I'm doing a brain dump. What's the guy's name?
I don't remember.
Shoot. We'll I'll let
two guys. He went into
two guys.
The, two guys from Brazil.
Yeah. Well, no. One was Rickard was a military officer. The other guy was British. He was from England.
Okay.
And I argue that the whole story you're going to read that you know well. You'll pull it up on Wikipedia. Some of you probably have already. And you'll say, well, it says right here that Burton just crossed the Andes. He went across the Argentine Pampas and crossed the Andes into Chile and you know, and all this stuff. And what you're saying is a bunch of bullshit. Well, here's the thing. When you really look closely, the sources of that itinerary are very thin. They're very just almost apocryphal. It's a lot of assumption. What I argue is that the other Brit that was with him, he is the one who did the exploration up the Chilean coast, and what he was looking for was the alleged mouth of the tunnel system. And then he came from the west to the east and met up with Burton and Rickard at the place they were at it's the country there, Paraguay.
Okay.
Paraguay.
Patagonia, and, Paraguay?
Yeah. And then I argue that from there, they went north back into Brazil, for Burton back into Brazil. Rickard was a mining expert. If, you know, anybody knew about the tunnel system and any strange stuff like that, Rickard would have been the guy. And then the other guy he was with, you know, another Brit who I present.
I'm sorry, it's in Argentina.
What?
Patagonia is.
Yeah, Patagonia is, yeah. 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 But they were in Paraguay on the river there because Burton had been there and had written some stuff. And I believe he did some more cover writing to cover their tracks. But he disappears after heading into the Argentine Pampas, after leaving Buenos Aires. He disappears and then does not reemerge again until 4 months later in Lima, Peru, in a saloon. And he spends days there drinking every day, kind of with the thousand-yard stare. And interestingly, gets word of his next Foreign Office assignment, and as Mary S. Lovell writes in her biography, he shrugs off this drunken alleged despair. He shrugs it off like an old overcoat and, oh, thank you very much, gets up, walks out, catches the next boat he can to England. And I argue in the book that, again, that he was just living his cover.
Yeah.
And what was he doing in those 4 months? Well, that's what I believe chapters 7 and 8 speculate about.
Okay, we generally probably have 15 minutes left.
Mm-hmm.
I had a couple other questions, believe it or not.
Okay.
You had one segment in the book where you say the Mayans had so much gold. It's like, where the hell did they mine
the
all this? Inca, okay.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Where the hell did they get it all
from?
Shall
we leave that for the readers, that little tidbit?
If you want.
Yeah, let's leave that. Okay. I have a theory, folks, about Puma Punku and what it was.
Yeah, because you say they also possibly stopped off there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would argue that in my speculative—
Does this have to do with this machine that runs the world thing that you mentioned in the beginning of the book and then sort of at the end?
Well, the machine is what I think Puma Punku is, but let's not say it.
All right.
Let's leave it to the readers. I argue that in this speculative itinerary, not only would Burton have been looking for, and I like to think he found the city, and there's a reason why I think he found the city, and that has to do with Colonel Fawcett, and I have a comment about that in a minute.
Yeah, you said you were going to get to Colonel
yeah.
Fawcett.
Here's the thing. I think that Lake Titicaca and Tiwanaku and Puma Punku would definitely have been something he would have been on his taskings to see. I have a theory which takes David Childress's theory on Puma Punku a step farther, right. Which I'm not naive. I'm pretty sure David probably thought of this too, but just is not as nutty as me and didn't want to go that far. I went that far in this. You can read that. Here's my thing with Colonel Fawcett. Those of you not familiar with Colonel Fawcett, look him up. Wikipedia him. There's going to be a movie coming out called The Lost City of Z.
The book that the guy wrote a couple years ago. He was all over
David
NPR
Grant.
For a while.
Yeah. I disagree with his conclusion. It's another consensus history. Oh, the city was just a big fancy Indian village. Bullshit. Anyway, on to the next thing. Colonel Fawcett, his expedition, his whole story, his disappearance, his search for his lost city, I'm convinced was a direct result of whatever Burton found in South America. My theory is that Burton did indeed reach the city of 1753, the city in manuscript 512. He filed a classified report of this expedition, this lost expedition. It remains in British archives. I suspect that Fawcett, who was an British Army officer, he had done some intelligence work. He himself admits that. He was also a... Are you ready for this? After he had done intelligence work, they made him a survey officer. He was a surveyor. Remember what I said before? The Brits loved using survey companies as cover for intelligence. So I argue that Fawcett, military officer, intelligence officer, I think his whole search for what he was looking for, his lost city of Z, was a direct result of the Burton expedition. And he probably, therefore... The logic would dictate was he read Burton's report on the manuscript 512 city of 1753.
Why? What did he say he found?
Burton?
No. The guy that...
Fawcett.
Fawcett, yeah.
Well, that's the thing. Fawcett was lost looking for his lost city of Z.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to give you one last little tidbit about Fawcett.
All right.
Everybody who knows about Fawcett, he talked about this mysterious lost city Z. He called it Z, the city Z. That's all he would call it was Z.
Yeah.
Well, guess what, folks? And Burton knew this, okay? Z, where it's located, is interestingly in the vicinity of where the ancient cities of the Americas described in the Book of Mormon were located, some of them, and one of those cities in the Book of Mormon, these lost cities of South America, is called Zarahemla. Do the math. Zarahemla. Say it with me. Zarahemla. It begins with a Z. I argue that Fawcett's mysterious Z was the Mormon Zarahemla. I think that I don't think that the city of 1753 in the manuscript,
meaning that Burton White would have mentioned it in his report that Fawcett saw and called it that.
Exactly. But all this Mormon information would have been in Burton's reports, and Fawcett went to look for Zarahemla. Now, this idea does not originate with me. There is a guy who has a website called Practical Eschatology, in which he is the first one to really ask the question. There's also a site on Colonel Fawcett. I think that they refer to this guy, but the guy that did Practical Eschatology, I think he was the first one that I found that asked, is Colonel Fawcett's Z the Book of Mormon Zarahemla? Now, remember, for those who came in late, earlier we talked about this. I don't buy into the Book of Mormon, the scripture. What I argue is that Joseph Smith found an actual account, and he plagiarized a lot of that information for his Book of Mormon. So it's not that I think that the Book of Mormon is God's word or the gospel truth or whatever. I think some of the information as regards the lost cities might very
well
be accurate.
Have you read that book that Bill Moore worked on called Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon?
I remember him talking about it here. I was on the show.
I wonder if the guy, the reverend who wrote that original,
right?
I wonder what that meant, because nobody knows where that manuscript is anymore. We have descriptions of it, I believe, but no actual copies of it. Like, because he hand wrote it,
yeah,
and sent it to a publisher, I think, in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
The publisher looked at it, had it for a while in a printing shop, thought about it, and then decided not to publish it in a printing shop where Joseph Smith worked for a few months. So that's, he said, it's much of the Book of Mormon is extremely similar to the point of, you know,
yeah,
almost exactly of what people said was in that book by Solomon Spaulding, I think.
Yeah, and Smith himself was an occultist. He was an occultist treasure hunter.
Yeah.
I mean, he talks about, when he finds these plates, he talks about these
spectacles.
But
it'd be interesting to see what else was in there. Maybe I can ask Bill.
Yeah, exactly. It'd be an interesting follow-up. Yeah. But here's the thing. This whole experience, all this stuff about, you know, what Burton might have found in was seen in Utah, what's in the Book of Mormon about the Lost Cities, honestly, I'd never read the details. I just kind of laughed. I laughed out loud. I'm like, folks, come on. This is Fawcett's City of Z.
Yeah.
You know? That was kind of an interesting little discovery. And the book goes into, after Fawcett, you know, who else might have been interested in this and such. But anyway, there you go. Did we have any questions from anybody?
No.
Oh, that gauges their
level. You answered everybody's questions.
So there were questions.
No, there weren't any.
So they're not that maybe they're disappointed. Who knows? They're stunned.
Walter, I don't often get questions where people are directly on the show because I usually don't take them.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's right. It's been a while, I guess, since I...
No, the reason I usually don't take... It's very selfish. The reason I don't take questions is because I want to talk to the guest and find out what I want to find out from them.
True.
Now, if somebody on the Facebook feed here asks a question,
That's what I meant.
Yeah. I didn't think of that. Oh, yeah. Good. We're having a siren.
There we go.
We didn't have one during Paul.
It would not be Radio Mysterioso without the siren.
Yeah, and that's just a police car.
Yeah.
I think we've gone off the main route for...
Ambulances?
Yeah.
Oh, or fire trucks.
Fire trucks. Yeah, it was usually fire trucks.
Fire trucks.
Or does there haven't been any fires around
here? Maybe they're all up in Big Bear.
Yeah, they're all up fighting all the fires around here.
So we answered all your questions.
And we kept basically the same audience throughout, Walter.
Good.
So it's been going up and down by one or two listeners, but we've basically kept the same audience. So don't worry about people not being interested because they stayed on.
No, I'm not. I can
tell when people aren't being interesting because it just starts dropping off and drop, which doesn't happen very much anymore. We got loyal listeners.
Well, I'll tell you, this one came out of a what the heck, and the next one, you know, I don't give it away, but I got to tell you, the next one I'm very excited about. It may or may not be actually in the Secret Missions series, because if I can't find a strong enough piece of evidence where I feel comfortable arguing that speculation, I'm still going to write a book about this particular individual because it's blowing me away. I'm reading deeper into his biography, and I'm learning things about him I didn't know. And expanding upon what I did.
Yeah, you always do that.
And the way I've been trying to think about it, it's kind of a different book for me in that the best way I could describe it is if you like some of Lavenda's stuff, and if you like some of Adam Gorightly's stuff, I'm thinking of the Manson book or whatever. Yeah. Not that it's a book about Manson. If you like their stuff, you might really like my next one because it gets even more into an individual and some strangeness that involves others you've heard of. Anyway.
Yeah. Well,
I'm off in the purple because I'm in the purple.
I am glad that you're still writing and then you keep writing because it's become very difficult for me for some reason.
I found strongly with Burton, I have some parallels in my career You know,
that was one of my questions. Is like, how did what you're doing inform this book? Because you mention it in the book over and over.
Yeah,
it's like I'm thinking like a agent, and this is what I think was going on.
Is that see? That's the other thing. People say, Walter, you know, Bosley, you pulling this stuff out of your ass. It's like, no, I come from an intelligence community background, and I'm telling you, I'm you're right. It's informing this, but the Cabrillo book had some resonance. This one had even more resonance, and the next one is just it's just pinging. You know, there's a personal resonance there.
So well,
and that's what I try to do. And that's another reason why I'm very secretive about what I'm writing until I release it, because I prefer to when I stumble upon something, the first thing I do is I go out there and look and see, has anyone written about this already? Because I'd really rather not just be one of several. I'd rather be maybe kind of the first guy to, you know, oh, yeah, that looked at this. Oh, wow, I didn't know that. Isn't that interesting? And then, you know, people can take it from there and whatever. Yeah. And it helps you think outside the box when you set aside that everything has to be. What it is a lot of people have gotten into this. Everything, again, it comes back to everything's got to be a debate. You've got to argue it, and you've got to win your argument or – you know, it's not worth writing a book or reading a book about it or whatever. And this is, as you know, this is what bothers me. This is why when people say, well, let's debate it. I'm going to say, I don't debate. If I want to bicker, I'll get married again. I'm not going to debate. You know, my argument is my book. Read it. As you say, read it or don't. You know, if my thing and what I do and my opinions and attitudes are not your cup of tea, then don't read my book. Seriously, don't bother.
Well, wouldn't somebody say that you're just backing away from criticism because it wouldn't stand up to criticism, or is your answer you're criticized in a way that has nothing to do with why you wrote the book?
Here's my answer to that. If I was backing away from criticism, I wouldn't publish the book and I wouldn't promote it. The book is out there for anybody to read and criticize. The book is out there. I'd pull the book I'd never publish the book. I'd do all these.
Oh, so you're open to criticism. You just don't want to sit there and have a debate with somebody.
Yeah, I'm not going to sit there and discuss it. Okay, you hate it or you disagree. Fine. My thing is once someone states their position, I disagree. Okay, thank you. I'm not going to sit here and try to convince or change anyone's mind, right? But, you know, if I wanted to be another person who's well-known in the UFO world who says I have all this stuff but never shows it, I don't do that. I say, I'm writing this book. I'll reveal it when it's done. When it's done, there it is. My name's on it. It's out there at Amazon and Lulu. I go on shows and promote it. And, yeah, I stand by it. But you're right. Yeah, I don't like to get into, you know, just, you know, bitching about the curtains, you know, which is really all that amounts to. You know, it's either, hey, enjoy it or don't.
Yeah, I just got hit with a huge wave of fatigue just now. I don't know why.
It's like, probably fatigue with me going on and on.
No,
but
it's fatigue with not sleeping enough in the last few days and then having two beers just now.
Oh,
as if people could not tell. Walter had a beer and I had two while we're sitting here doing this. Then I had some ice green tea, which actually balanced it out and speedballed it for me.
If I had had two beers, I would have been, you know, dozing off myself. So,
yeah, you want to play a song?
Sure.
What song?
Hell, I don't know.
What do you like, Walter? See, I've been doing this thing in the last couple months. The guest gets to determine the outro song.
Oh. There's a song that,
and I don't care what it is because I'm not, you know, I don't care.
I've been listening to, you know, little odds and ends, and
I'll probably just find it on YouTube here.
There's a great cover of House of the Rising Sun by a group called Frigid Pink, Frigid
really?
With a J, and I love it. I love their cover. It's more of a 70s rock bluesy type cover of it, not like the. You know, I mean, I know it's an old New Orleans blues song, but Frigid Pink. But the song, do you remember the song Mendocino?
Yes.
Okay, by the Sir Douglas Quartet?
Yeah.
Quintet?
Yeah.
That's actually, when you think about it, that's kind of a creepy song. Here you have a guy, you know, a grown man, and particularly when you see
They're not contemporary. This is from 1971.
Yeah. What's interesting about Mendocino, to me, it's kind of comically creepy in a way when, you know, you see in the 90s 50-year-old men singing about their teenage lover. You're like, ooh. But there's a verse in the song Mendocino in which it talks about smooth-talking guys with strange red eyes. And they come and they lure his little young girlfriend away from the house by the river, the love house by the river. And I was reading one of Tim Beckley's books about strange phenomenon this weekend, and and there's some weirdness having to do with Mendocino. And I thought, you know, between that song and those stories, there's a horror movie in there. And I like ironic music where it's like it sounds like it's happy, but there's something dark. Anyway.
I found it.
Oh, which one?
Frigid Pink, House of the Rising
Play
Sun.
It.
Is that it?
Yeah, and I definitely want to use this in a horror film. before I forget, not only am I speaking at the Secret Space Program.
Oh, yes, please.
In Texas on October 31st. There's a few people, I think, that are in the Radio Mysterioso Facebook page group that are going to that. So I'll see them down there. I'll be signing books. Joseph Farrell will be speaking at that. Catherine Austin Fitz and some others. So, and then hopefully the next book, nonfiction book in December.
And the present book is, I keep wanting to say Secret Missions 2, but
It's Secret Missions 2, The Lost Expedition of Sir Richard Francis Burton. And you can get that at Amazon on Kindle, or you can get it printed at lulu.com.
All right. I think you'll like this stuff. I've played this stuff before, but it's crazy Japanese surf guitarish guy cool. From the 60s. Oh, I'll play House of the Rising Sun by him.
Oh, cool. Excellent.
Thanks, Walter.
Thank you.